So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Right? Yep, I'm rolling here. Johnny, yeah, turn your TV off or whatever that is. Make sure your phones are muted and vibrate.
Let's see. I did all that, but I can't do, Jeff. Yeah. I can't mute the assholes who are still beating the crap out of me for showing kindness to Kim Fox at a party.
I know
George Soros, yeah. The George Soros prosecutor, the first one, the one that helped destroy the Chicago that I love, was gracious at a party, at a holiday party, Tom Serafin's party. You know, you have to be there. It's sure. All the movers and shakers, and who shows up on the front page of a Politico and a big story? Me and Kim Fox, and we're smiling like loving teenagers or something. And now I'm being called a commie.
Oh, the horror, John. How dare you? I don't get people sometimes. I mean, don't get me wrong. I have plenty of differences with Kim Fox and her ilk, but life's too short to be in a fight 24/7, man. Everyone's got to have a good time every now and then.
The voice you just heard is Rafael Manguel, who is the senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, the Nick O'Neill Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor of City Journal, a member of the Council on Criminal Justice, and his first book, which I tell you everyone must read and you should get it for Christmas, Criminal Injustice, was released in July of 2022, and he has co-authored many, many articles for City Journal. I read them all, and he's our guest to talk about the Soros prosecutors and the scourge that they have left behind. Rafael, welcome to the Chicago way, my friend.
Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure to be on with you guys.
So I know I'm going to do most of the talking because our good friend Jeff is suffering from COVID. Jeff Carlin, friend of cats, maker of pies. And I'm sorry, Jeff, we love you, but you're not here. But in the meantime, what is going on with the Soros prosecutors? We know that Kim Fox was one of the first, if not the first. And since then, I guess Soros appears to be suffering rejection at the ballot box from cities that just can't take it anymore. Yes?
There's definitely been some pushback, which is a bright spot. I wouldn't quite declare victory just yet. I mean, 2022, the midterms did see quite a bit of victories for progressive prosecutors throughout the country. So, it hasn't all been sunshine and rainbows, but I do think that people are starting to voice their skepticism at the ballot box, and I think that's a good thing. It's interesting. I mean, Soros was just very, very successful in this strategy of targeting these offices. And part of the reason he was so successful was because, by and large, you're talking about down ballot races that are determined in primary elections that are held, usually off cycle with the federal elections. They don't get a lot of turnout. They don't garner a lot of attention. And so, it's a really cost-effective strategy when you consider the amount of money that typically goes into these races, where you can, buy quite a bit of airtime, and you got to tip your cap to the brilliance of the strategy. what's changed in the last couple of years is that sort of since 2016 and since the first dominoes fell between Chicago and St. Louis County with, you know, the unseating of Robert McCullough by Wesley Bell and, you know, the election of Kim Fox in Chicago and Larry Krasner in 2018 in Philly, et cetera. You know, people are starting to wake up and, you know, how could they not? You know, we went from a time about 10 years ago where no one would have ever heard of the term progressive prosecutor. And now some 70 million Americans are living in jurisdictions with one of them at the helm. And so, you know, as people start to, you know, sort of put two and two together and, you know, they look at the post 2020 crime spike, which we're still experiencing by and large. And the kind of insanity of the policies that, you know, have been enacted and pushed by some of these quote unquote progressive prosecutors, you know, it was only a matter of time until we started to see some pushback. You know, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that the fight's over, that, you know, this snowball will eventually turn into a boulder. But yeah, there's possibly some light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah, one step toward freedom is not freedom. It's just one step toward it. And I'd suggest that in this, I think there's 75 jurisdictions where progressive prosecutors backed by Soros have won elections. There has been pushback a little bit in New York, a little bit in Pennsylvania. I don't know where else, but I mean, it's a
Loudoun County, Virginia.
Yeah, Loudoun County, Virginia.
San Francisco.
Prosecution. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We, you know, that fellow's from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
What's his name? The one raised by wolves?
Chesa Boudin,
raised by wolves.
Interestingly, you know, now that you mentioned your story with Kim Fox, I actually received a gracious invitation from Chesa Boudin to participate in a sort of series of debates at a conference that he's going to be co-hosting at Berkeley in March. And I agreed to participate. So my understanding is that I'll be on a panel with some decarceration and abolition advocates and, you know, apparently, Larry Krasner and Chesa Boudin and potentially Kim Fox even will be in attendance. So I'll, make sure to say hi for you, John.
Please say hi to everyone and, embrace them. the thing that people don't understand is that the arguments for decarceration, the argument for defunding the police, it's all based on the argument that law enforcement is racist. And I saw your excellent Soho debate in which you posited the opposite. But for those of us who haven't seen it, isn't that the argument? And how do we defeat this argument?
Yeah, I mean, there's the way I like to put it is basically the sort of radical reformers are driven by a narrative that has three prongs. Prong one is that we have a mass incarceration problem that we need to address. And, you know, by just logical extension, given how they frame the problem, right, as one of mass incarceration, the obvious solution would be mass decarceration if they're to get their way. Prong two is that we have a police violence problem. And prong three is that both police use of force and incarceration disproportionately impact minority men. Therefore, we also have a systemic racism problem. And that third prong really does quite a bit of the work because it's intimidating morally, right? Very few people want to risk looking like they are standing with the racists, right? And if everyone's told time and again that the criminal justice system is racist, that policing is racist, that incarceration is racist, well, you know, good people are going to have a hard time pushing back on that, especially if, you know, they have careers that they care about and families that they care about and lives to live and, you know, communities to stay on the right side of, etc. But it really is a pernicious claim. And, you know, there are quite a few holes in it. You know, you kind of mentioned the Soho debate that I did against Radley Balco, formerly of the Washington Post. And there were a bunch of arguments that I made there. But, you know, the kind of top two, in my opinion, that really poke a massive hole in that case is one, you know, the argument about systemic racism rest on an approach of statistical analysis that's just fundamentally unsophisticated. People look at these top line disparities and they stop their analysis there. They say, well, if there are disparities, those disparities are prima facie evidence of discrimination. They don't attempt to understand why those disparities may exist, right? We hear, for example,
they paralyze themselves.
Yeah.
They paralyze themselves because they're terrified of being called racist.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. I mean, you know, take, for example, George Soros, who wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal not too long ago, sort of defending his approach to the decarceration debate. And one of the things, in fact, the only statistic that he cited in that entire piece was that Black men in the U.S. are five times more likely to be incarcerated than white men. And from this, we are to understand that, you know, incarceration is a manifestation of America's deep-rooted racism. But what if that disparity is a function of other disparities in behavior, in victimization rates? And what you start to do is, once you actually dig into that data, it becomes very clear as to why that disparity might exist, right? You have Black males who make up approximately 7% of the population and nearly 50% of homicide victims. Well, right. If policing and criminal justice resources are going to be responsive to that problem, the problem being that, you know, for Black men, the homicide victimization rate is about 10 times what it is for white men.
Right.
Well, then police are going to have disproportionately more opportunities to interact with people who live in the neighborhoods where that problem is concentrated. Right. And take Chicago, for example. You look at the 10 most dangerous neighborhoods in the city of Chicago, places like Austin, West Garfield Park, Inglewood, etc. And what you know, Humboldt Park, what you're going to find is that the 10 most dangerous neighborhoods in 2019 in that city were 95% Black and Latino. Their collective homicide rate for that year was in excess of 61 per 100,000. The national homicide rate that year was 5 per 100,000. And if you dig into some of the more dangerous neighborhoods, West Garfield Park being the most dangerous one, their homicide rate was 131 per 100,000, which literally makes it just as, if not more dangerous than any of the battlefields that our Marines fought on in Iraq and Afghanistan at the height of those conflicts, right? And so when you consider the demographic overrepresentation of Blacks and Latinos in the neighborhoods where serious violent crime, particularly gun violence and homicide, is concentrated, you start to understand why we see some of the disparities in enforcement that we do see in the data, right? And there's no denying that there are disparities in the enforcement data. The question is why they're there. What does that evidence? And I argue that it does not evidence racial animus. Now, that's a major hole. Yeah, that's a major analytical error, but it's not the biggest one. If you're considering the systemic racism critique, to me, the single largest problem with the way that that narrative is framed stems from the following fact, which is that critics of the criminal justice system treat enforcement outcomes as if they are the only outputs of policing, prosecution, and incarceration. They fail to understand and include in their analysis the fact, and it is a fact, that policing, prosecution, and incarceration also produces crime declines. Every single study of any note, of any analytical rigor that's been done of policing, whether you're talking about investments in police departments, the hiring of additional officers, the expansions of patrols or police presences, proactive measures, you know, focus on hotspots, whatever, every single one of those studies shows that those policing initiatives reduce crime. Same thing with incarceration. The general consensus in the criminological literature is that for every year the marginal prisoner is incarcerated, we are abating 8 index felonies. And that's really an undercount because those estimates are based on crime reports and the vast majority of crime doesn't actually get reported. So it's probably more like 10 index felonies for every year that the typical person's incarcerated, right? And in order to incarcerate somebody who has committed a crime, you need an arrest, you need policing, you need a prosecution, right? So those things actually produce crime declines. Now, the question then becomes, what happens when crime goes down as a result of the operation of the criminal justice system? Who benefits? What do those benefits look like? Are they evenly distributed? And the answer is no. They are just as starkly racially disparate in terms of their distribution as the costs associated with the operation of the criminal justice system. So if you look at something like the homicide decline of the 1990s, right? Between 1990 and 2014, homicides decreased more than 50% in this country. And you ask yourself the very simple question, well, how were the benefits associated with that decline distributed? Well, it turns out that the homicide decline added a full year of life expectancy to the average Black man's life in this country. A full year. The public health equivalent of that, just to kind of put it in perspective, would be to eliminate obesity as a disease. If you compare that to white men, they only saw 0.14 years of life expectancy added. Now, that's about an 8x difference. So when you start to consider that the distribution of the benefits associated with the criminal justice system are very, very disparate, it becomes, you know, less tenable to hold the position that the criminal justice system is racist. Because when you see a study, for example, like the meta-analysis that Morgan Williams, Aaron Chalfin, and a couple of other criminologists did looking at the effects of hiring an additional police officer, what they found was that the hiring of every police officer abates 0.1 homicide a year, which means that you hire 10 cops, you save one life every year. The effects were twice as large in Black neighborhoods. Twice as large. So you have to ask yourself the following rhetorical question, which is, why on earth would a system allegedly designed and operated for the specific oppression of Black and brown men so disproportionately benefit Black and brown men when the system achieves its stated ends? This is the question that I've yet to see a good answer to, right? If in fact, you know, police chiefs and, you know, law and order prosecutors and criminal court judges are racist in their efforts to detect and enforce criminal offenses, sometimes by prosecuting and incarcerating those who are guilty of them. Well, if they're so racist, why would they continue to do that, given what we know about the benefits associated with that project and who enjoys them? It doesn't make any sense.
Two things. These are not major. They're major offices to me and other people who follow crime and care about their communities. But to the parties, they're not. I mean, they're not national offices. They're local prosecutors. But the machines, there were such a thing as the political machines that could influence these things. The Democratic machine in Cook County, for example, could influence elections in low turnout, off-year elections, and drive so they could control the assessor's office, the prosecutor's office, etc. But now the machine has changed to become, in Chicago, it is run by the Chicago Teachers Union, which is hard left, and the media that basically writes about this stuff for the general populace is committed and firmly on the left. You work for the Post, or you write for the Post, New York, but the rest of it, the rest of the media landscape in New York and in Chicago is regrettably sloganeering for the left wing. And so therefore, nonsense like that Kim Fox and Tony Preckwinkle put out get currency.
Yeah, the legacy media has utterly failed over the last two decades in terms of living up to its responsibility to fairly cover issues of criminal justice. I mean, there is no way around that fact. When you consider the just lack of sophistication in so many of the arguments that have been advanced in favor of relatively radical reforms that have far-reaching consequences, yeah. I mean, I have been just utterly astounded by the lack of intellectual curiosity and scrutiny on the part of legacy media outlets, places like your former employer, the Tribune.
Right.
You know, it's pathetic. You know, and don't get me wrong, that doesn't mean that they haven't done some good reporting. I mean, there was a series of investigative reports that David Jackson and some other people led a while back, looking at the bail reform in Chicago. And you know, kudos.
Yeah, to I remember for that. That was a good piece.
Yeah, it was a great piece, great series. And you know, kudos to the Tribune for printing that. The problem is that, you know, for every one of those, you know, honest, you know, scrutinizing pieces, you get 1,500, you know, puff pieces that, you know, just right. buy the narrative about hook, line, feelings. And sinker. Yeah. And, you know, and the reality is, and, you know, I try not to sort of impugn the motives of people on the other side, but it just becomes harder and harder not to ask this question, which is, you know, it's hard not to wonder whether this has something to do with the fact that in cities like Chicago, the costs associated with this radical project are relatively concentrated, although that's changing, but have long been relatively concentrated in neighborhoods that the well-to-do and the politically active don't dare spend any time.
So they don't care because they're not involved. They think that their money isolates and protects them, and it doesn't. Well, the other day, I wrote a column about a young lady walking down the street. You know, one incident doesn't tell a whole story.
Of course.
I understand that. And anecdotally, it doesn't. But we have to be wary of that stuff. But here's a woman, 23 years old, child, in my mind, could be my daughter's age, walking down Michigan Avenue, chatting with a friend, and a guy hits her in the face with a log.
I saw
a log. You saw that, right?
Yeah.
What's the reaction that people have to such a story?
Yeah,
or the stories that you have written about in terms of New York and attacks on the subway, et cetera.
There are a couple of important points to raise with something like that, especially when you're talking about random acts of violence that are happening in public spaces that have high economic and social value, right? I mean, the Mag Mile is in many ways the lifeblood of Chicago's retail industry, right? You're talking about a strip of land with retailers that range from, you know, extremely high end to, you know, sort of middle of the road. But it's a huge part of the economic engine. And so, you know, it's a huge problem when people don't feel secure walking up and down that particular avenue. And when you have these random acts of public violence, that sends a very clear signal to people that they're not safe in those places. And it does so in part because those events are not predictable, right? It's not like this woman was, you know, walking through Humboldt Park, you know, at midnight on a Saturday with a $100 bill taped to her forehead and a Rolex on her wrist, right? This is Mag Mile, middle of the day, you know, police all around.
2 p.m., the height of civility.
Exactly. And the
civilized neighborhood.
So when that can happen then and there, it hits different, as the kids would say. You know, it creates a sort of deeper sense of insecurity. And if that sense of insecurity metastasizes, I think people would be surprised just how quickly a space like the Mag Mile can lose its luster. You know, it wasn't that long ago that it was mostly empty. I mean, you know, you go back to the mid-80s, early 90s, and right, it was a very different feel. We can get back to that. It's much easier to get back to that than it was to get to the point that it was at in, say, 2012, you know, which is when I moved to the city of Chicago and, you know, would walk around my neighborhood and that area without any fear or reservations whatsoever, even at, you know, the wee hours in the morning after, you know, a late night in the library or, you know, a later night at the bar. And so that's really problematic. The other aspect to this, though, is that sort of invariably when you read these stories, what you see is that whenever the perpetrators are caught, you're talking about people who have very, very extensive criminal histories.
Yeah.
Tons of arrests, prior convictions,
violence,
active criminal
not
justice.
Just, not just the bullshit where they sell nonviolent. No, these guys are violent offenders.
That's exactly right. Although I recently wrote a piece for City Journal kind of talking a bit about this false dichotomy between the violent and nonviolent offender, right? One of the points that I want to make is the sort of true test of whether someone is in fact a nonviolent offender is to try and interrupt the nonviolent offense and see whether they use violence to successfully pull it off, right? I mean, you know, by and large, a lot of the reason that we, you know, people feel comfortable saying that, you know, the groups of teenagers who, you know, kick the door in at, you know, Saks and raid the Montclair coat rack, right, and walk out. The reason you can call that nonviolent is because no one dares to interfere.
Right.
But try and get in one of their way. Yeah. Try and stop them and see how quickly that nonviolent person becomes quite violent.
Or see if your girlfriend is walking by and says, no, don't do that.
Right.
Then what happens to her? She gets stomped.
Exactly. So, you know, the idea that we can sort of reliably categorize these offenses as nonviolent, I think, is misguided in its own way.
So what's the way out, Rafael? What's the way out?
One thing you have to do one thing you have to do, especially in a city like Chicago, where, by the way, the typical homicide and shooting suspect has 12 prior arrests, almost 20% of them have more than 20 prior arrests, right? The first thing you have to do is you have to draw a line in the sand as to repeated criminal offending and say, beyond this point, no more, right? You may be able to get away with, you know, X number of crimes. You may find yourself back on the street, but at some point, we need to be able to confidently assert to the public that people who move beyond this threshold are going to go away for a very, very long time. And there are a couple of benefits that are associated with that. One is, you know, the sort of the obvious deterrent effect, right? Knowing like, okay, well, I'm on strike two. I don't want to get to strike three. But the other is the incapacitation, right? Whenever you read these stories of these heinous crimes committed by people who, you know, are out on parole, they have an open case, so they're out on pretrial release. Right. They've got 15 prior arrests, 4 prior convictions. Mm-hmm. Everyone always asks the same question, which is, what's this guy doing on the street? Well, it's about time that the people in power start answering that question.
But they won't answer it in Chicago, at least. If, you know, I'm no longer writing the page 2 column for the Chicago Tribune. I was the guy who would get in the Tim Evans' face. I would see Tim, the chief judge. I would get in his face at an event. And what about this and that? But people don't want to do that now. Okay, that's their decision. But the people, the consumers of the news, don't support that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, I think we're seeing kind of a balkanization in terms of media consumption, where, you know, legacy media outlets have just been written off by the center, by the right.
Right.
And so that just encourages them further. And so it's a real problem. It is. And I don't pretend to have the solution. But one thing that I do know is powerful is the stories of victims. And I know it's powerful because the left has done a really great job of leveraging those stories to push their own reforms, right? I mean, you know, how often do we see a case? I mean, take, you know, the shooting of Adam Toledo, which, you know, was a lawful shooting, right? I mean, it was tragic, of course. It was a 13-year-old kid who was, you know, running through a dark alley at 2 a.m. on a Sunday with a gun in his hand.
They crucified the police officer. They crucified
him. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it was, you know, it was a lawful shoot. I mean, you know, I did an analysis of the case, watching the footage, and this guy had milliseconds to make a shoot, don't shoot decision as this kid was turning toward him with a gun in his hand.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that is, you know, that's not a situation anyone wants to be in. But that story led to real significant reforms being enacted with respect to foot chase policies. And now foot pursuits are significantly less likely and the public's worse off for it. So, you know, we see that, you know, terrible tragedies like that can be leveraged to make really bad policy, I don't see why we should write off the possibility that, you know, highlighting the stories of the victims that have borne the brunt of the costs associated with this misguided project can't help turn the tide. Right? I mean, I opened my book with the story of Brittany Hill, who was murdered in Chicago in 2019. Yeah. This was a 24-year-old woman who was standing out in front of her own house, broad daylight in the neighborhood of Boston, holding her daughter in one hand when a car pulls up and the occupants open fire on the group that she was with. And this woman was mortally wounded. And, you know, while she's holding her daughter, shielding her daughter from the gunfire and saved that little girl's life. And now this little girl is going to grow up without a mom. Why? I mean, one of the guys who was arrested and charged with that murder had 9 prior felony convictions and was out on parole under the age of 40.
So what's
that guy doing on the street?
Right.
That's the problem. That's what needs to change, right? Because if we had any kind of respectable rule of law that actually drew a line in the sand and said, you know, you only get so many bites at the apple, guys like that don't end up back out on the street. And people like Brittany Hill stay alive, right? I mean, people in these neighborhoods, they have so much to deal with already. I mean, you're talking about economically depressed places. You're talking about, you know, places with really high violent crime rates, with, you know, excess shares of broken families and, you know, so many social problems. Don't make it worse by putting a guy who has shown you and proven time and again through his repeated criminal conduct that he has no intention of playing by society's rules. How do you justify that imposition on a community that already has so much to deal with?
With all that you expressed and interesting and compelling thoughts, the question, when I'm Sybil, you know where I stand on this thing. I want George Soros prosecutors, Tim Fox, Tony Preckwinkle, Tim Evans, the whole bunch voted out of office and disgraced. But because I'm Sybil at a holiday party, do I lose my moral authority to discuss it?
Of course not. Of course not. I mean, what were you supposed to do? Challenge her to a duel? I mean, you know, I'm as you can probably tell by the tone of my voice, I'm a pretty laid back guy. You know, don't get me wrong, I'm a pugilist at heart, and I'll happily go into political debates, right, and into the fray and get to the bottom of these issues, as I know is true of you. But, you know, the idea that in a situation in which, you know, that would be totally inappropriate and unproductive, right? I mean, you know, what are you going to accomplish in the middle of a holiday party?
There's times for the tomahawks and there's time not for the tomahawks, but
that's right. Even World War One was temporarily suspended for a Christmas celebration between the trenches, right? I mean,
in the forest of Belgium. Yeah, right. I think that's where it was. Christmas truce, as you're referring, which brings me to the second question that is on Jeff's mind and my mind. No cash bail. I'm looking at the destruction. I'm looking at a state like Illinois and New York and other places where civilized people have to flee. My wife wanted to get out. We left and moved to Indiana. I'm a Chicago guy. I don't want to live. I'm living in the place of no flavor now. I lived in Flavor Town. Now I'm living in fried food land. I love the people of Indiana, but it's illegal to find garlic and oregano in Indiana. They think it's pot or something. But what about that issue with no cash bail and in Illinois, New York, California, et cetera, where the progressive left destroys another part of our society?
Yeah, look, I mean, you know, the cash bail question is an interesting one, right? Because here's a topic on which I actually have sympathy with the critics. I am sympathetic to the sort of central critique of cash bail, which is cash, a system that heavily relies on monetary conditions on release is both unjust and inefficient insofar as it produces the following outcome, which is that a relatively dangerous but well-off defendant gets to buy his freedom while a relatively harmless but indigent defendant gets stuck behind bars, right? If what you're doing is trying to achieve public safety through the pretrial detention process, this is an inefficient way to do it, and it will create unjust outcomes, right? So I'm on board up to that point. The problem lies in the execution. What happens is in places like New York, for example, or in New York is actually the only place in which this happened, we basically took cash bail off the table for almost every crime that's going to go through the system. And we maintained a prohibition on the judicial consideration of dangerousness, which means that New York is the only state in the union in which judges cannot consider the risk that an individual defendant poses to public safety in any aspect of the pretrial release inquiry. So they can't consider it when determining whether or not this person gets out pretrial. And they can't consider it when determining what, if any, conditions to place on that individual's release, such as an electronic monitor or, a supervision program or, you know, some other kind of pretrial services requirement. So it's just the most misguided version of that reform that you could possibly have. What we saw in Illinois started with what happened in Chicago under Judge Evans. And Chicago was kind of the sort of smaller scale experiment that, you know, despite going exactly how everyone predicted, anyone with sense predicted it would go, didn't deter the state from expanding on that effort. Now, at least in theory, there are some situations in the state of Illinois where dangerous defendants can be held pretrial. The problem is that you have a judiciary that has demonstrated time and again that it doesn't have the resolve to hold those dangerous defendants even when they're asked. And in some places, like in Cook County, you have prosecutors that have an aversion to asking for pretrial detention, even in appropriate cases. And so what ends up happening is that even if you have a sort of system in which, you know, the reform is great on paper, like New Jersey, right? I mean, the way that New Jersey did bail reform was outstanding on paper. And yet, just a few years after that reform was enacted, they had to go back and sort of tinker with it to expand the presumption of detention for people charged with gun offenses, because judges were not reliably holding them pretrial. And so, you know, any reform that you have, even if it's the best reform you could possibly imagine on paper, is only as good as the prosecutors and judges that are implementing it. And that's the fundamental issue with the way that cash bail is being reformed in Chicago. You know, when you have these individuals who come through the system multiple times, they start to get to know that system, and they know that, hey, if I get arrested for X, Y, and Z, I'm almost certainly going to be out within 12 hours, certainly within 24 hours. And that becomes a sort of part of the deterrence calculus, right? I mean, you know, one of the elements that really impacts deterrence and whether or not a policy deters is the sort of temporal proximity of the sanction to the act, right? And so, right. You know, how soon after you commit the crime do you experience some cost associated with having committed that crime? Pretrial detention used to be one of those first immediate experiences, right? You're arrested, you're taken off the street, which is an inconvenience, and it's immediate, but it's temporary, right? And if you're back out on the street in a few hours, then the arrest doesn't really matter so much. But if, you know, you get arrested and you know, hey, the next 3 days might be behind bars while I, you know, end up getting my money together, well, then, you know, that means your whole weekend's shot. And maybe that's a reason to not do the stupid thing that you would otherwise have done. So that's one thing. But the other thing, too, is, again, just the incapacitation point, right? And when you fail to detain dangerous people pre-trial, some number of times those dangerous people will go on to do terrible things. I think the CWB Chicago has been covering this issue pretty well for a while. I think they've counted, yeah, you know, more than 26 individuals who have been charged year. With just this right. year charged with either, you know, murdering, attempting to murder somebody or shooting somebody. Shooting. And so, you know, that's
while on
pretrial release. Exactly. While out on pretrial release. Now people say, oh, you know, that's just 20, but that's just, first off, those are really, really high cost offenses, right? I mean, the social costs of a homicide or an attempted homicide are massive, right? A successful homicide, can cost society upwards of $9 million. I mean, you know, it's no small thing to take life. You know, but those aren't the only offenses that these individuals are going out and committing, right? And there may only be 26 instances of shootings or homicides, but there are hundreds of robberies and carjackings and thousands of burglaries and thefts, et cetera. Like, all of those costs, you know, when compounded, are real, and they're massive, and they sap the public's morale. The public stops respecting the system. It also saps the desirability or the willingness of people who might have otherwise cooperated to cooperate. Why? Because the costs of cooperating have now gone up. How? Well, if I'm asked to give information to the police that might help aid in the prosecution of a dangerous person, I might be willing to do that if that person is securely locked in a cell at 26 in California. But if that person is out on the block and I'm going to have to walk past him every other day, believe that I'm incentivized to keep my mouth shut in that situation.
Right.
And so these costs are just not considered. And, you know, it just becomes, you know, this sort of revolving door system where people ultimately lose respect for the system. And the system needs respect in order to operate effectively. And, you know, one of the things that you're seeing with this policy, look, you can't lay the entirety of the crime spike at the foot of bail reform. You know, let's be clear about that.
Right.
The question is whether we are worse off or better off than we otherwise would have been. And I think it's very, very clear that cities like Chicago, places like New York are worse off. And, you know, I think the data make that very clear. I mean, in New York, we saw like a 25% spike in the share of arrests constituted by people with open cases in year one of our bail reform. There have been multiple analyses of the bail reform in Chicago, including the one highlighted by your former colleague David Jackson and his colleagues in that expose, that show that, yeah, crime did go up in Chicago when the Evans bail reform went into effect. We saw more crimes than we otherwise would have seen. And you know, what defenders of the reform like to do is they like to obfuscate, right? They'll say, they'll put out a study saying, well, look, you know, post reform, when we control for all these other factors, what you don't see is any increase in the rate of offending by pretrial releasees. And so, you know, whatever, it'll say, you know, 10% of pretrial releasees reoffended prior to the reform, and that didn't change after the reform went into effect. Therefore, the reform didn't change anything. But here's the thing. You've expanded the number of pretrial releasees. Right. So you're talking about 10% of a larger number. So even if it's true that the share of releasees reoffending remains static, if you grow the number of releasees drastically, as these policies do, you're still talking about an increase in those sorts of crimes.
Rafael A. Manguel, the Nick O'Neill Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor of City Journal, a member of the Council on Criminal Justice, his first book, and I recommend, it's a perfect gift along with a year subscription to John Cass News, where you get your cool No Chumbalone hat, is a perfect gift for Christmas. If you have someone in your life that's a law enforcement officer, someone who cares about being able to walk to and from their home without being smashed in the face with a log, I recommend Mr. Manguel's book most highly.
And if you have a blue-haired progressive cousin or aunt, feel free to send it to them too.
That's perfect. It's more, almost like inviting them for Thanksgiving to my house, where I can talk about free markets and the effect of what happens when we kill free markets.
That's right.
Rafa, thank you for being here. And one more thing I have to remind everyone. His first book, Criminal Injustice, in parentheses, Injustice, was released in July of 2022. And I love it, and I recommend it most highly to all the blue-haired commies on your Christmas list. Sooner or later, truth will out, and we will reclaim our nation with people like Rafael Manguel. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for being here on the Chicago Way. For Rafael Manguel and for Jeff Carlin, executive producer of WGN Radio, friend of cats, baker of pies, and man with COVID, which is restricting his vocal cords, and for Rafael Manguel of the Manhattan Institute and City Journal, thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.